again, and welcome to another edition of Will's Band of the Week. And we're here for part two of our favorite music of the decade. We've got Barrett here.
Hello.
We also have Chris here.
What's up?
The listeners probably think that we all went home after that first recording and thought about our top five and stuff, but I'm going to let them in on a little secret. It's sort of like they do with game shows and soap operas and stuff. We're gonna record two back to back, but you don't get to hear them right away. You got a little break in. So
you're giving up our secrets, the tricks of the trade.
We actually just spent 5 minutes discussing the the study that shows that if you look at breasts long enough, you'll actually live longer because it's like exercise or something. Gets your heart rate up or something.
That did come up during the break,
which explains why I'm actually 300 years old. Can you believe some researcher actually got funded for this thing? He's like sitting at his computer. He's like, well, I'm going to be doing this all day anyway. How can I get money for this?
Well, and if he got some results, I guess that validated the research, right?
Yeah, you'll have to link to this so people know what we're talking about.
a lot of scientists will need to replicate the study to make sure that it's valid.
Yes, I'm sure they're already replicating it multiple times all over the world. Anyway.
Let's mention that people can email us at willsband@yahoo.com, or they can go to willsband.net and post a comment about how you don't like our picks, or maybe you like them.
I'm 300 years old. I don't know how to use a computer. These flashing lights.
What would you say, Chris, you know, if you expanded this to like the best music of the last, say, you know, 260, 270 years or so, you know, what do you see as the trends?
That one time my neighbor was hitting a stick against the tree by his house.
Yeah.
That rocked.
Yeah, it was like...
I like a lot of his earlier stuff.
Cool.
Though.
All right. We're going to kick this one off with me. I'm going to assign myself to start this one out. And I'm going to play my... or tell you about my number five pick. The fifth best release of the decade, according to me, is the Flaming Lips album called Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. This was released in 2002. And the first album I had by them was The Soft Bulletin, which came out in 1999. And for a while, I thought, you know, that's going to be as good as they're going to do. That's such a great album. But I think in some ways, and this is obviously arguable, but I think in some ways the Yoshimi album is even a little bit better because it goes for the mood a little bit more and not for the always the poppy songs. And I do have a little story to tell about this album. My late uncle, several years ago, he was roughly 70 years old, and he was a big music fan, but mostly classical. And he had some neighbors that were playing their stereo really loud, and his idea was to respond to that by trying to have a stereo war with them. And so he asked me for a recommendation for some rock music that he could play. Because, you know, you can't do a stereo war with classical music, right? So I recommended the Flaming Lips album, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. And he sent me an email, which I saved. He said, "This morning I purchased the Flaming Lips CD that you recommended. The older goth woman at the checkout asked me what type of music this was. I told her I didn't know, that I was acting on the advice of my nephew." And then he says, "At any rate, I think the CD is marvelous, sound-wise and artistically, vocal and instrumental, too. Parts of it are extraordinarily clever. One piece sneaked up on me and almost brought me to tears. Actually, it did, but I am embarrassed to admit it. I thought the Yoshimi parts were really inventive, with some super synthesizer work. I also appreciated the playful nature of some of the sounds. The lyrics in Do You Realize and All We've Got were really poignant, I suppose because they're true. It is good to be reminded of such facts, and when we least expect it." So I thought that was pretty cool coming from
what a cool old guy.
My 70-year-old uncle who, and you know, it made that impression on him, which I thought is pretty cool. So
he can articulate things about music that we simply cannot.
He's more sophisticated as a classical fan, I think. I picked kind of the obvious track, just because I thought it really was a classic. So I'm not going for the deep cut here. I'm going for the obvious, and this is a track called Do You Realize?
The podcast has taken kind of a, well, I'm treating this like it's one, but really a somber tone. But that song, while it's somber, is also very hopeful. You know, I think he's got some good advice there.
Made all the more hopeful by the pink bunnies in the video.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, give it up for Uncle Pete, though. Or wait, what's his name? Uncle
Charlie.
Uncle Chuck.
Yep.
Nice, nice. Way to go.
All right, let's hear from Chris. What do you got at number five?
Okay, now this is going to be somewhat controversial just because I think a lot of people would have their first album on their top 10 rather than their second album, but this is the Arcade Fire. And the album I picked was Neon Bible, although their first album was the one that really garnered them all the attention. But I, you know, I'll defend it. I think this is a better album. I tend to look at albums, being a political guy, as like a political campaign where I have to defend myself against every attack coming. But no, I just think the songs on here are more solid, and you know, it's just a great listen from beginning to end. Whereas I think the debut album, although clearly it came first, and you know that's what people heard first, I think there's some pockets in there that are uneven. So. For this, I went with Antichrist Television Blues.
Okay, let's hear that. Arcade Fire from Neon Bible. Antichrist Television Blues.
Down.
I swear since mid 05, I've read probably 20 reviews of new bands that are considered to be, you know, arcade fiery. So you can see the impression that they certainly had on music, in, at least in the last half of the decade.
Yeah, the Funeral album was like a totally an indie rock classic if you look at, you know, just the whole indie rock scene. But I'm actually with you, Chris. I think that Neon Bible is actually a better album. Funeral has kind of a cool theme to it, and it has like half of it are really good songs, and this one's better. It's actually better.
I'm not going to take a stand on that. I like the first one better, but I'm not going to fight you about it.
You're going to concede.
Well, let me put it this way. I like the first one better. I didn't listen to the second one as much. So while I'm taking a stand, I'm not going to fight you on it. I'll concede that you guys are probably correct.
And I think I've seen Funeral on at least two or three end-of-year lists, or, I mean, decade lists, and I haven't seen Neon Bible on any of them, so...
Funeral,
here we stand.
Funeral, I would imagine, sold, like if you look at all the CDs or downloads or whatever that Merge has ever sold, I bet Funeral is still 25% of that.
I bet it still sells, you know, it's kind of like the indie Dark Side of the Moon, you know. Do you remember when Dark Side of the Moon was like, I'm a little bit older than you guys, but Dark Side of the Moon used to be on the Billboard charts, like, all the time, like years and years and years after it was released, 10 years, 20 years after it was released, it would still be in the top 100 or whatever they were keeping track of. So people just kept buying it.
Is that the first White Stripes album?
So it's basically like the Bible of music. Like, yeah. I think the Bible is still the best-selling book every year.
Yep. Yeah, just... It keeps on going.
Which brings us back to Neon Bible, which is my pick.
That's right.
It all comes back, Parrot.
Yeah, but you got the Antichrist in the song.
Circle of life.
Yep. Okay, so let's see. What do we got now? I think we're up to Barrett's number five pick.
Yep, my number five pick is LCD Sound System. And it sounds like the name of a band, but it's really one guy. Is it James? What is his name?
James Murphy.
James Murphy?
Yep.
And this is his second album, and I loved his first album, which was a double album. And, you know, if he had pared that down to a single disc, I might have liked it as much as this. Anyway, LCD Sound System is, and if you had to classify it, you'd say it's electronic music, but it's really got a lot of humanity to it, a lot of soul. And, you know, in these albums, you can hear, you know, a lot of Eno and Bowie and, you know, but kind of in the background, there's always kind of a dance beat to it. But this particular song is called All My Friends. It starts off with kind of a piano thing that's rather than, you know, with dance music, you've got like a metronome-like piano. It definitely sounds... is being played by an imperfect human player, and there's a lot of that going on this album. That's one of the reasons I like it.
When I first heard this band, I thought, I don't know if I can get into this because sometimes he's kind of on the same note for like 5 minutes.
That's definitely the case.
And you're waiting for the chord to change, and it never happens, you know? And I ended up getting this one, and it actually ended up becoming one of those albums that the family liked, you know, driving around on a summer vacation in the van. So, yeah. LCD Sound System. This is from the album Sound of Silver, and this is All My Friends.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love that album, and that's one that I certainly would have had on my top 10, although that's the one song that I probably would not have picked to play. But I think the thing that I like about it the most, for a couple of things. First of all, I think it shows a really great sense of humor for being kind of a dance album. I mean, you think of dance albums as kind of being more robotic and automatronic, but I mean, this really has a heart and a sense of humor. The song North American Scum, I think, is particularly funny, and it kind of straddles the line between kind of being proud of America and also kind of ridiculing American culture at the same time. So you just don't see that in dance music a whole lot, and I just think it's great that way. Also, James Murphy's kind of a fat guy, so I'm for like fat people making good music. Gives us all a chance.
That's good. Yeah, you feel like you could make it. You know,
his drummer just within the past 6 weeks died.
He fell down
an elevator shaft in Brooklyn at a party.
Oh man,
mm-hmm.
That's horrible.
Also, the drummer for the Juan McLean album that I liked a lot in 2009, that didn't make my list, but that's ancient history now.
We've got kind of a death theme going here, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
All right.
Who's up next?
Well, my number four is up next, and it's from the band Bright Eyes, which is sort of a band, and it's sort of a guy named Connor Oberst. He's put out some albums as Connor Oberst, and he's put out some albums as Bright Eyes, and basically, you know, he's the mastermind behind the whole thing, and I think this was the second or third album that I heard by Bright Eyes, but this one is called I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning. Came out in 2005. Actually, he released two albums at the same time. This one is the more acoustic, folk-oriented, and the other one is a little more electronic. This one was obviously my favorite, and sort of passionate country folk or something like that. I couldn't figure out another way to characterize it. He's been, Connor Oberst has been pretty active in this decade, and I think this is the best album he made. So let's play a piece. This is called We Are Nowhere and It's Now.
And if you swear that there's no truth, and who cares, how come you say it like you're right? Why are you scared to dream of God when it's salvation that you want? You see, stars that clear have been dead for years, but the idea just lives on in our wheels that roll around as we move over the ground. And all day it seems we've been in between a past and future town. We are nowhere and it's now. We are nowhere and it's now. In like a 10-minute dream in the passenger seat while the world was flying by. I haven't been gone very long, but it feels like a lifetime.
Yeah, I like Bright Eyes. He was kind of, a polarizing figure in this decade. I think a lot of people liked him right at the turn of the decade. And why did people? He's kind of came across as a bit of a weenie. I think that's what people didn't like about him. And his voice is
kind of polarizing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if somebody sings that way naturally, that's cool, but it crosses the line, I think, and comes across as an affectation sometimes, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm probably on the other pole of the Bright Eyes fan club. I could never get into him, and I think most of it is because he's so young. Didn't he start making albums when he was like 18 or 19
yeah,
or something? And
yep.
I'm generally yep. against people that much younger than me achieving things in life. So
yeah.
I just want to smash him upside the head.
Another example of somebody who's kind of gone more into the, I don't know, blues country kind of direction, and I haven't liked his more recent stuff quite as much. So, but obviously he's so young, who knows what he's going to do.
I don't know how young he is anymore. I bet he's about 28 now.
Yeah, probably. Yep.
Getting close to 30.
Yeah. Okay. Now it's time for Chris's number four pick.
Yeah, for my number four, I picked Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, which was a little bit of a sensation a couple years ago. Came out in 2005. Barrett and I actually went to go see him at a really small place here in Madison in concert. Every time they come on or I play them, my wife refers to them as the Talking Heads band. I mean, because he sounds so much like
David Byrne.
Like David Byrne. Yeah, so it's just a great album from beginning to end. You know, it's certainly some of its higher points are better than others, but when they hit a high point, they really do hit a high point. So I picked the last song on the album, Upon This Tidal Wave of Young Blood, which manages to say the word child stars, I think, about 67 times in a row. So, but we probably won't hear it. So anyway, this is Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah.
Upon This Tidal Wave of Young Blood.
Yeah, you didn't get to hear the part where he says child stars over and over again. So it sounds roughly like this. Child star, child star, child star for about 12 minutes. But yeah, it's a great song.
Wasn't this a band that got their following through sort of word of mouth over the internet? I remember reading that about them.
Yeah, this is, I think, I should probably research this before I go spouting off, but I want to say this is when Pitchfork really flexed its muscle for the first time, and they gave this a glowing review, and this is some independently self-released thing that ended up on some guy's desk, and he decided, I want to put a review on Pitchfork that's 10.0 or whatever it was, and it was close if it wasn't 10.0,
mm-hmm.
and it blew up, and the other one that I can remember like that was Tapes and Tapes.
I was just going to say the same thing.
And
yep.
That was really the apex of Pitchfork's influence And everybody, you know, still familiar with Pitchfork and still, you know, checks it out, see what they're reviewing and whatever. But I thought that was kind of a big thing in the middle of the decade, that bands realized, like, hey, wow, I don't need a label. I don't need any promotion and all that stuff, which is actually completely, you know, bullshit. But a couple of bands got lucky with this, and all of a sudden the idea that you would need an A&R guy at a label, even an indie label, you know, people thought that was unnecessary, and I think that was kind of an unfortunate thing, and people devalued what the label A&R guys brought. And I still really rely on the labels that, you know, like Domino and Merge and Matador and whatever. Let these guys listen to everything and give you what they like, and there's still 1,000 things to choose from.
Yeah, that's true. But there still is that factor out there that a writer, a reviewer can have some influence by just saying, hey, this band is fantastic.
You can always count on Barrett to stand up for the suits.
Yeah, well, yeah.
He's so in the pocket of corporate America.
He is, yep, absolutely. A corporate shill.
You guys don't see any value in the independent labels? I mean,
oh no,
you can look at something on you look at Amy Street and stuff. Say if there are two things that are a dollar, one is like just some dude, and the other thing is on, say, Domino.
Yeah, well,
I know what I'm going to want to listen to.
Yeah, well, what you know is that someone decided to put money into it, and they were betting that it would be popular.
Right.
You know, so it tells you something, but still, yeah, I think both are valid points of view.
Nope.
Am I going to have to separate you two? You go over there and sit in the corner.
Well, that leads us right into your number four pick, Barrett. What do you got?
My number four is The Shins, a band that put out their first album in 2001. And I remember hearing this. I remember I was at a restaurant on State Street. You know, I remember before I got it. I remember buying it at B-Side. I remember going home and listening to it. And it's a sound that in the rest of the decade got to be kind of typical. And I think they were really influential. But when this album came out, their first one called O Inverted World, I think the sound was just new and thrilling and totally different. And, you know, they took a big hit, I think, when that movie with Natalie Portman came out. And she famously said, "The Shins will save your life." And then anybody that's, like, not a nerd decided The Shins were not cool anymore because of that. And but looking back at the end of the decade, All Is Forgiven, and that was one incredible record. And I think their second one was really good, too. But what do you guys think about it?
Well, I got the second one before I got this one, so that's what I was referring to earlier, I think, on the Part 1 podcast, that we were discussing which album you hear first has an influence. So I actually heard Shoots Too Narrow first, and I got to really like it. So then I got this one, and I thought, well, it's good, but it's not quite as good as the other one. So, and I think I could have gone the other direction maybe if I heard this one first. They're both really solid.
Yeah, I've seen some lists where they have Shoots Too Narrow, you know, hovering near the top 10 albums of the decade, with O Inverted World nowhere near it. And, you know, I don't mean to overstate things, but I actually think that's akin to an act of terrorism. So, because this is such a brilliant album, and I loved it from the second I got it. You know, when it came out, and what was it, 01, 02, something like that. So, yeah, this is one of the ones that you stole from me, you bastard.
Okay, this is The Shins from 2001 and their album O Inverted World, and this is called Girl on the Wing. Just
I would like to see, or to hear rather, more young bands come out with albums that include some harmony like that. Harmony is just killer. And why don't more people use it? What do you think, Will?
Boy, don't know. Can't
explain. It's harder to do than just to sing, you know, the melody, and then you just, the other people just shut up and play their instruments. I mean, that's easier. True.
But I'm a guy who can't sing, so I tend to be sympathetic to the bands who can't sing. The Shins are for Portland, Oregon, aren't they?
I think they were actually from the Southwest, and then they moved up there.
Oh, maybe Albuquerque.
Yeah, that's right, Albuquerque.
Yep. Did they ever move to Brooklyn?
They didn't. Well, I don't know.
They weren't going to follow the trend.
No.
Yep. Good album, good band. All right. Should we proceed to number three? We're getting down to the serious stuff now. I've got a number three here. It's The Brother Kite. This is probably, I'm going to call it the underrated album of the decade because no one else has ever heard of it. But this band called The Brother Kite from Providence, Rhode Island, had an album in 2006 called Waiting for the Time to Be Right. And I think that the best way to describe it is it's shoegaze version of the Beach Boys. So I'm going to play the last track on the album. This is called Never in Years. Brother Kite.
Yeah, I can see where you'd find the Beach Boys comparison in there with those kind of Pet Sounds, Christmas Bells.
Yeah, they do a lot of harmonies and vocal styles of Beach Boy style, I think, too.
Yeah, you turned me onto that album. I liked it quite a bit. I especially like the opening track, which is, it's got like a 3.5 minute intro that's just kind of soaring with no with no lyrics whatsoever. And then there's about 30 seconds of lyrics, and then the song is over.
Yep.
And I think it's just a great song. It's like called Coat of Arms or something. So,
yep.
But yeah, it's a good album.
I hope we hear more from them in the future. So, Brother Kite, if you're out there, try to put out something.
And I was just talking about how more bands need to use harmony, and there's one that heeded my call.
Yep, they did. They answered.
You know, not,
good for you.
Not literally, you know, because one would assume that they had recorded that before, you know. Before we went to the break there.
Yes. Yeah.
But I like that. I know I listened to it, but I wasn't listening to it very attentively before. And nice job. Well, I liked that surprise selection.
Okay, now we're going to hear from Chris and his number three pick.
Yeah, this is a record you're not going to see pretty much on anybody else's top 10 list. And it's a band that that our friend Steven turned us on to quite a while ago. The band is Clem Snide, which is sort of kind of in existence still, but not really. It's essentially a gentleman named Eve Barzelay. In 2000, he came out with an album called Your Favorite Music. And to me, this is absolutely the perfect album. I mean, it's got everything you'd want. It's got the musicianship. It's got, you know, it's got warmth. It's got humor. It's got a real nice acoustic feel to it. And, you know, I've seen it criticized as being a little bit too slow. But, you know, if you listen to it, there's just so much going on here. And, you know, he's continued to make albums throughout the decade that are all really, really solid. But this is what got me started. And to date, I still think this is Clem Snide's best album. So this is the song Exercise off of Your Favorite Music. And it appears to be about some kind of physicality of a relationship or something. But who really knows? But it's a great song.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I loved Clem Snide throughout the decade. Saw him a bunch of times. And kind of, I think, Madison and Milwaukee, even though he's, well, I know that he lived in Brooklyn for a while, and then he moved down to Nashville. I don't know where he's from originally, maybe from New York. But I think he had a really loyal fan base in Madison and Milwaukee. Yeah, so he had a lot of affection for those cities and played them a lot, and we saw him a lot. And that was a musical memory that I'll have of the 2000s is lots of Clem Snide concerts.
You guys will have to drag me there when he comes back.
Next time he comes, we'll... I think the last time I saw him, he was just at Momar, maybe.
Which was what? A capacity of 100 or something?
Yeah, I mean, he's still... You know, he's the example of a guy that spent his entire life in a band and, you know, still kind of has to go play small shows and... Pretty much, you know, from what I understand, still kind of living paycheck to paycheck. He's actually just supposedly just gotten a job as a teacher and still trying to make music. So, you know, for every band that you see that's an overnight success and, you know, Pitchfork raves about them and suddenly they're millionaires, there are, you know, 100,000 guys who are, you know, still out there struggling. But still making great music. And that's, you know, this guy's an example of that.
Cool. Barrett, we're up to your number three.
My number three is by The Strokes. And it'd be hard to talk about music in the aughts. Is that what we call it? The naughty oddies?
Yeah.
I have heard that a lot. People are at a loss for what to call this, but in the aughts or the 2000s or the zeros, it'd be hard to talk about that this decade without talking about The Strokes. And this album came out in 2001, I believe, or actually it's 2000. Is that right?
According to my records.
2000. It was just all over the place. I know the anticipation before it came out was huge. And at least in my ears, it didn't disappoint. And I really liked it. They put out 3 albums. Second one, also very good. Third one, maybe not as good. And then they all kind of did their solo stuff. And Julian Casablancas actually came out with the solo album this year that I heard was really good. And I want to get it after going back and revisiting the Strokes as we were trying to put this list together, because I thought the music is just as exciting. And there aren't many albums I thought that came out in the last 10 years that stand up to this. So the album is This It, and the song is called Someday.
Probably should really love this album. You know when I got this album?
When did you get it?
About a month ago.
Yeah,
I'm a little late to the game, would you say?
Late to the party.
But you know, I've got an excuse because as we mentioned, the album came out in 2000 and my twin sons were born in 1999. So, you know, I wasn't really scouring the music scene at that point in time. And then by the time I heard of the Strokes, I guess they had you know, I don't know. I just didn't go back and get it. So now I have gotten it.
There was a period when, in about 2000, 2001, when all the rage were bands that started with the. You had the Strokes, the Hives, the White Stripes. Everything was a the band. And they all kind of had that kind of, you know, garagey type of feel. I mean, they're not, you know, treading any new musical path, but, it, you know, they are just refreshing. And, you know, kind of in the way they did it, they took, you know, familiar styles and made them their own. We actually went to go see them in Madison upon release of their second album, and it was funny because that night the Orpheum Theater actually caught on fire, and they had to evacuate the place. And the funny thing is, the name of their second album is Room on Fire, so it was kind of ironic that, you know, the place would catch on fire. So
was that any time around that Providence fire? I mean, I think I'd be freaked out if I was in a rock club that started on fire after that. When was that Providence?
What was that? Great White?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like 15 people died or something.
Right. Well, they didn't have any.
100. Oh, 100? Yeah, it was a lot of people.
Yeah, they
did. Including a couple of band members, right?
The real shock there was that many people were there to see Great White.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I had to bring it back to the death theme somehow here.
Yes.
So, yeah, and one thing about the Strokes, too, you're never going to get an 8-minute song, you know, that you
right.
can't wait till it ends. You know, it's like great short attention span music.
And another funny thing about the Strokes is, you know, here we are in 2009 and, like, you know, half the bands that you hear about now are from Brooklyn. Well, these guys aren't from Brooklyn. They're from Manhattan. But when they came in, you know, bands from New York. It wasn't like the big thing. It wasn't like another band from New York. It was sort of a new thing at the time, at least by my recollection, don't you think? And it's also sort of I thought sort of a precursor to a trend that I saw for the rest of the decade where a band would become so big even before their first album is released that there's a bit of a backlash. So it becomes fashionable to like them and then unfashionable to like them even before the album comes out. And these guys all happen to be, you know, these rich kids from Manhattan, and one of them, their dad is a, you know, a this, and the mom is a fashion designer. And these kids, if you knew them in high school, that you would really hate them, and they'd just be just real jerk offs.
Sounds like Vampire Weekend.
Is that their backstory too?
Well, I don't know. Maybe Chris knows more about Vampire Weekend. They seem like sort of the rich kid types, you know, with the Izod shirts and stuff.
Yeah, that's actually the impression that I got from the Brother Kite. They were kind of like monogrammed sweater wearing.
Yeah, I think they were wearing
kind of
sweaters,
preppy rock.
So,
yes.
Yeah. So we all have our sweater wearing fans. like.
That's actually why I've avoided up to this point releasing my solo album, because I'm really trying to avoid the backlash, because people are really looking forward to that.
Well, you got to build the anticipation, so you got people on both sides, you know.
Chris thought I was reaching to unbutton his shirt, but I was actually reaching for the microphone to explain what Chris is wearing. Chris is afraid of the backlash because he's dressed like, how would you describe this? Well, first of all, he's wearing spats, which is sort of a 1920s type of a thing, and he's got a beaver skin jacket on, even though we're in the warm studios, which are about 71 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But Chris is sort of an old school rich kid type thing. He looks like a frat boy from 1930. So that's why that's what he was talking about.
It's a little. It's a little peek inside the podcast. All right, let's move on to number two. And anticipating what Barrett was going to say, I decided to pick a band that moved to Brooklyn. And this is The National, originally from Ohio, and subsequently determining it to be advantageous to move to Brooklyn. The National has been around, I don't know, probably since early in the decade. And the album I've picked as my number two album of the decade is called Boxer, which I believe is their fourth album. So they've been around a while, and I think a really good example of a band that just kept getting better and stronger as they progressed. And it's just a great album. I don't know what else to say. So I'm going to play. I decided to go with the lead track. This one's called Fake Empire.
Stay out super late tonight, picking apples, making pies. Put a little something in our lemonade and take it with us, put life away in a fake empire. We're half awake in a fake empire. Tiptoe through our shiny city with our diamond slippers on. Do our gay ballet and dance. Bluebirds on our shoulders. We're half awake in a fake empire. We're half awake in a fake empire.
This is one of those albums that I just thought was really meticulously recorded with really good musicianship, and just the whole thing just was put together just great. And I really liked it.
We went to go see them at here in Madison at the High Noon Saloon, and it was funny because we got there early enough where the band was out eating at this table next to us, and my buddy Mike was there, and he's like, "That guy, get a picture of me with the lead singer." And so he like walks over there, and we get a picture taken with this guy. Turns out the guy's not the lead singer. He's not even in the band. He's like a roadie. But he's the one guy, like the whole band must have just been dying that like one of their roadies, some guy goes over. He's like, "Let me get my picture with you." So that's my national story.
They were playing pool before the show, and a couple of the band members, and I ordered a beer right next to the lead singer. So yeah, it's my brush with fame.
That's right.
So there you go.
You guys are tight now, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're going to hear some more from the National in the future, too. So I'm hoping. Okay, it's getting pretty serious now. We're up to Chris's number two pick.
Yeah, number two. No messing around now. This band, I think, shook rap music out of its out of the doldrums. It had become a parody of itself, and still is for the most part. But I think they completely re-energized the genre. They brought humor, they brought musicianship, all the things that were lacking in rap music at the time. And I'm speaking, of course, about Outkast. This is the album Stankonia. And I picked B.O.B., which, of course, stands for Bombs Over Baghdad, which ended up being prophetic, actually, because 2 years later we were actually dropping bombs over Baghdad. So. Yeah, I mean, this is just a brilliant album, and it stands up with the best of them of the decade. So, Outkast.
Okay, here we go. Outkast. B.O.B.
International underground thunderbounds when I stop the ground. Like a million elephants, a silverback orangutan. You can't stop a train. Who wants some? Don't come unprepared. I'll leave there, but when I leave there, better be a household name. Brother man telling us it ain't gonna rain. So now we sit in a drop top soaking wet. In a silk suit, try not to sweat. Hit summer songs without the net. But this be the year that we won't forget. 1999.
Yeah, when you look at the rappers of the aughts, I mean the ones that come to mind are guys like Kanye West and Jay-Z, but I just think Outkast is just so far ahead of those guys. They're just light years ahead in terms of musicianship, in terms of their flow, in terms of the witticisms, the intelligence. I just think it's they just blow those guys out of the water.
I would not qualify as a rap critic in any sense, but you listen to something like that and it's cool because it's outside of the usual genres of music that for me that I would listen to, but it's very energetic and it makes you want to listen to more. Wasn't there a popular song on that album called Hey Ya?
Was that a different
album?
That was on the next one that came out.
Because somebody gave me that track and I'm like, I got to admit, this is pretty catchy.
Right. You know? And I like that album a lot. Actually, it was kind of two albums. Speaker Box / The Love Below. And that almost made my list. And I'm glad Chris included this on here. And it does kind of just sort of draw on, you know, paint a picture of these three guys sitting in this broadcast booth here, saying these are the best albums of the 2000s. And it's overwhelmingly, you know, one style of music. And I think last week's podcast or 2 weeks ago, Chris pointed out that, you know, we're not pretending to tell you what's the best, and there's a lot of different types of music, and we really just sort of concentrate on the one type that we like. So kind of nice that Chris had this on here. And you know, there are a few rap albums that I liked, but like Will, I'm not someone that would claim to be a critic or someone with much knowledge about it, but I like a few things. I liked Outkast a lot. And I'm glad that Chris did, too.
Well, thank you for that compliment. You're just a regular Benetton ad, bringing us all together.
It's what Barrett does, brings us together.
Maybe that even sounds patronizing or something. I don't mean it to.
Okay, we are really getting close to number one here. And we're still on number two and ready to hear from Barrett on his number two pick.
My number two is by a band called Wilco that I think most people would agree one of the bigger acts of the decade. And I think most people would also agree that this was one of the bigger albums of the decade, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And the song that I chose is called Pot Kettle Black.
Okay, let's play it. This is Wilco from Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, Pot Kettle Black.
Rockets, who has a magic wand? Empty out your pockets, who was without a song? I myself have found a real
a hard album to pick a song from, isn't it?
It is. I picked that. So yeah, there were a number that I could have picked. I like that song, but you know, the album is really kind of a one piece of art, and you know, it came out 7 years ago, and
2002, and must have been recorded before then, because the story behind it is that it got rejected by their record label, right?
They were on a Warner label, right? And then Warner cut them. This might all be wrong. I might have the label wrong. But then Reprise Records, or Reprise, ended up picking them up. But they're an imprint of Warner. So Warner basically paid for them twice. So, you know, that's kind of dumb. And the album went on to sell, you know, tens of thousands, which is a lot, you know, for an album of that stature. Probably upwards of 500,000 copies, I think. And yay for Wilco. Great album. Love it. My second favorite Wilco album.
Well, let's take the easy transition then. It's time to talk about our number ones. Can you believe it? We made it all the way. And shockingly, my number one album is by Wilco. It's called Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
I've heard of that album.
And so Barrett and I, we're our number one and two here, and our number eight we've got in common. And well, Chris would have had him, but he cheated and he changed his picks after he read Barrett's.
That was consistent.
I don't know that. Actually. Yes, I don't know that that's necessarily cheating.
Okay, you can.
I was trying to help Barrett out.
Yeah. Okay. I thought that Yankee Hotel Foxtrot was just the overall best album based on just on liking it on a basic level and also on some level kind of admiring it. I just think it's got a great combination of taking sort of simple, almost folk songs that you could just play on a guitar and then embellishing them in a way that makes them just really interesting. And I think we might have made reference before to Jay Bennett, who passed away this year, and he was the keyboard player, and I don't know, he played some other instruments too, didn't he? I don't know, mainly keyboards for Wilco at the time this album was recorded, and had a big influence on, I think, how it eventually ended up sounding. So I picked a song, I had a hard time, picked a couple, but I'm going to play a track called War on War.
Seems like every time Wilco now comes out with an album now, that's kind of a time where the whole indie music community kind of gets together and kind of takes stock of where indie music is these days. It's almost like kind of like the G8 summit for hipsters every time they have an album come out.
Yep, and I think we're going to go see them live, aren't we?
I think we are. I think I bought some tickets for that.
I think I was supposed to write Chris a check.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But
wait,
he's got to give you the tickets first.
Actually, I think I did write him a check already. Remember?
You bastard. No, you didn't.
That's in, next month, I think. No, not next month.
February.
2 months.
Yeah.
But
it's
yeah,
sold out in
fun.
4 minutes or something, or 11 minutes or something like ridiculous like that.
I will grant you, you have given me at least $160 worth of hugs. So, I mean, there is a cash value
really
to
that. Have to pay, yeah.
That's only four hugs, people. They're expensive.
They're good, yeah. All right. Now, this is time, you know. Chris, it's all led up to this. We're
all
up
led
to number
up to
one.
This.
We don't have the fancy music or anything to play. It's just up to you now.
Yeah. All right. My number one album of the decade, And I have no qualms about this one at all. This is Sufjan Stevens, Come On, Feel the Illinois. And it's just such a great record. I mean, because it's, you know, it's literate. It's the second part of his project where he was going to go state by state and start writing an album about each state. So he started with Michigan, and then he moved to Illinois. And, you know, you can just sense all the research that went into this album, because so many of the songs are, you know, about the Lincoln-Douglas debates and all different kind, you know, the city of Decatur and all these little minutia about the state of Illinois where he, you know, he's not from. He just kind of went through the history books and read up on all this stuff. And then the musicianship, I mean, it's like unlike anything that you've ever heard. Some of it sounds kind of like, a marching band. Some of it's, you know, these sweeping orchestral songs. Some of them are really quiet, acoustic songs about cancer and things like that. But it always all stays within the framework of, you know, something having to do with Illinois. So, I just think it's an absolutely brilliant album. The song that I picked was Come On, Feel the Illinois, which is the kind of the song that introduces you to the whole album and gives you a really good feel of what it's all about.
Okay, here we go. This is Sufjan Stevens. Come On, Feel the Illinois.
And that song goes on and on, and then it kind of morphs into a completely different song, which is about Carl Sandburg, you know, writing about Abe Lincoln, and there's stuff in there about the World's Fair when it was in Chicago, and kind of the whole Industrial Revolution that was taking place at the time. And it's just, you know, and from what I understand, he played the great majority of those instruments by himself, kind of recording them into his computer. And with the depth and, you know, the number of instruments, to me, that's just amazing. So, I have no problem making that my best album of the decade.
The John Wayne Gacy song is great, too. It's a really...
Well, I mean...
What do I want to say?
As Chris was saying, the research that went into this is pretty impressive. And, this song, Chris alluded to the 1893 World's Columbian Exhibition or Exposition, one or the other, Exposition. And that was a huge, huge, huge thing in the world and something that actually put Chicago on the map. I mean, this was about 20 years after the Great Fire, and people doubted that Chicago could put this together, and they did. And so you hear references to the White City, and that's what they called it, and the Ferris wheel, which was introduced there, and
cream of wheat.
Yep, that's the first time I had it. I don't know about you guys. But anyway, yeah, not good, only, good selection. That was the guy was huge in the 2000s.
Not only lyrically, but just musically, it's just pretty amazing, and doesn't really sound like anything else. So
right,
it's a great pick. All right, well here we are to our final pick, and all roads lead to Barrett's choice.
Yep,
the number one album of the decade.
I'm going last just by chance. But before we got started, and you know, we were talking about our lists, and I said that I had, you know, or Chris rather said that a good number of mine were ones that he might have had on his. If this is one that would also be on there, Chris, just nod your head. Yeah, he's nodding his head. This was a big one. And I probably should have picked the first song on the album, but I didn't. I picked one of the last ones. And it's called The Morning Bell, and the album is called Kid A. And this is from the year 2000.
And we might mention that the band is Radiohead.
The band is Radiohead.
Radiohead's one of those bands that is pretty popular by, you know, standards of most of the music that we listen to, but they deserve it. So it's kind of cool when a band gets big and but yet they're still just an excellent band.
Right. So that's the aughts. That's the 2000s.
Not going to let me talk about Radiohead?
The floor is yours, Chris.
All right. First of all, this is one of the ones that I'm happy you took from me because I would have needed at least four slots in my top 10 for various Radiohead albums. Kid A, Amnesiac, Hail to the Thief, and In Rainbows are all great albums. And I was thinking about, and I wrote something about this, that it's not very often that you see a band who at the same time is the most popular band in the world, yet is also making the best music at the time. And I think Radiohead may be the most recent example of when we've seen that. And I tried to think historically when that was the case. Like back, I thought maybe Zeppelin might have been the case. You know, they were making great albums, but still kind of getting panned by the critics. But, you know, since then, you know, Radiohead loved by critics, loved by fans. You know, they're still selling out stadiums everywhere. So I don't know, just a little mental exercise to think about. What, you know, how often, you know, since the Beatles have you seen a band that is making music that good and yet that popular?
I think there's still a band for music fans because they they still aren't for everyone, and I've had friends who just can't handle them. Like, I think they think that Thom Yorke is too whiny or something, you know? It's not music necessarily for the masses, but it's obviously music for a lot of people because they've got that that following, and it's a big following. I'd like to see them live. Have you ever seen them live?
I have, a couple times, yeah.
I would think, you know, here at our, we've got an arena here that holds 17,000 or so. I thought, you know, that's an obvious place for Radiohead to play, and I'd go. But I've never had a chance to see them.
No, they're great live, and, you know, they've sold out everywhere that I've seen them play. So,
did you have to go to Chicago?
No, I actually saw them once at Alpine Valley.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And, you know, of course, the sound there isn't all that great. But, you know, I mean, you've had bands like Pearl Jam, who, very popular. Were they the best band at the time? I'd say Nirvana was probably better, but Pearl Jam was more popular. So, I don't know, a little parlor game you can play with yourself at home when you're not playing with yourself at home.
All right. Well,
on that note,
hey, we've made it through the list. So I hope everyone has found it at least mildly entertaining to listen to our selections.
I'm gonna just reel off about five things that didn't quite make my list. I really liked Granddaddy's The Software Slump. I like several Godspeed You Black Emperor records. I'm gonna note that one of the, I think, bigger trends in the middle of the decade was when the Postal Service came out, and everybody loved that at the time, and that seemed to be a sound that was going to kind of, you know, a lot of people are kind of imitating that. But today it's fallen out of favor and everybody discounts it, and I don't like it anymore. But that was pretty remarkable. Coldplay was one of the bigger bands of the decade, and I thought their first album, Parachutes, was pretty good, and I liked that quite a bit at the time. Anybody else have any near misses?
One of the bigger trends for me for the decade was really gaining weight. That was really one of the one of the more profound trends that I noticed in the last 10 years.
Yeah, you know, that's cool. We were mostly limiting our...
Wasn't this a music podcast?
Mostly, yeah. Yep. But if we were talking about the top 10 trends in Chris's life in the past 10 years, we've got some kids. We've got,
sure. Some I know, you know,
some example. Did I don't know if anybody heard that?
He was in the background, so that's okay. Yeah, you know, I guess I went through and I found 10 albums I liked a lot, and I didn't really study the trends or anything. So I guess what I've got is what I've got.
Yeah, I think it would be unfair of me to pick 10 extra now that I essentially got 20 picks.
Yeah, you got some extra picks.
Sure.
So all right, well, thanks you guys, and it's been a lot of fun. So do you think we'll do this 10 years from now?
Yeah, I'll see you in January 2019.
Yeah, 2019. Wow. The years just fly by, don't they?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll revert to our humble one band of the week shortly.
Thanks, everybody. Well, we've got a holiday podcast coming
up. We're hoping to do a holiday podcast, so we'll just see if that comes to fruition. So stay tuned. Thanks, everyone.
All right, see you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Good decade. You rock.